Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Taiwan, all kinds of places. And they're trying out India, although my understanding is that they still haven't quite established a good commercial chain for manufacturing in India. So they're working on that still. But, you know, American workers want to be paid a good wage, and companies that hire them want to make a good profit, and so stuff is expensive. The only thing more expensive I found than American hardware is, say, German hardware. I mean, they are built like veritable tanks, but you have to pay the price of them. They're about as expensive as tanks, a lot of German manufactured equipment.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting quickly off topic, but there's a lot to talk about there, I think, including the way Americans view the BMW as some kind of high-end car, but in Europe, it's just the everyday car. Lots of people drive BMWs, they're everywhere. It's just a more normal mode of transportation for them. And anyway, I just wanted to know if the finding with the light in the water, if there was something you could do in the sense of a swamp cooler, that this discovery would benefit. Could you make one work more efficiently or at higher temperatures where they usually fall off quickly in efficiency? Just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, I would think not. I mean, personally, what you're doing is you're introducing another heat source rather than using a reflective surface that will reflect the heat of the sunlight away from you and your unit. You are you're using it to heat up the water that will evaporate and then will cool, but probably will cool less than it would if it wasn't exposed to absorption of all the sun. So I would think that it would be more efficient for a swamp cooler to be non-absorbent of sunlight. You know, you build it nice, shiny white, so most of that energy would be scattered out of the system.
That just was curious if there was a way where, yeah, I guess you could introduce the light without a lot of heat, but I'm just probably not sure. Anyway, yeah, I've been working to insulate mine better against that type of environment. So this past summer was the hottest summer since I moved here 7 years ago, and boy, I was scrambling to keep that sunlight and heat off of that unit all summer because, you know, above like 95 or so, the thing really starts to drop off, and it'll need to make the house comfortable. Anyway, again, we're getting off subject again. Thanks for your comments, Roy. AC2GS from KC2SHO.
AC2GS, very welcome, John. You know, no matter how you work it, light is electromagnetic radiation. It's energy. If you allow that energy to be absorbed by local matter, it will end up dissipating as waste heat. And your average kinetic energy temperature goes up, not down. That's why some people are working very hard on material paints and such that not only will reflect the sun baking down on everyone, but turn the thermal energy in the paint into infrared and be readmitted into the sky and just kind of bounce the heat waves back into space, so that they actually can lower the temperature below the ambient temperature just by reflective losses of things like infrared. So they're working on all kinds of interesting paint pigments that have that effect. The trouble is stabilizing it, and what happens if your paint gets dirty? It kind of ruins the whole effect. But they're working hard on it, so we'll see what happens.
Interesting. The magic word is photon. It can deposit energy into the matter. The was a forum. It was presented that made me to focus on it. So it's like, is it possible to make one penny important? Lift it to the important element of our future. So I'm going to give you some additional quote from that article. Postdoctoral MIT, Yong Chu Professor, and Gang Chen, and many other, along four of other co-authors, conducted series of experiments simulating using water drops into hydrogel and soft material. They found that under the certain conditions when the light hits the surface of the water-air interface, it can knock off water molecules and make them escape into air. This effect is more efficient than heat. I'm going to stress the this effect is more efficient than heat, which needs to rise the temperature of the whole water mass before evaporation occurs. I don't agree with that, but we're not going to stop here. Completely. The researchers say that this phenomenon could have implications for many natural and industrial processes, such as formation of clouds and fog and seawater desalination using solar energy. It could also help to improve the accuracy of climate models, which currently do not account for this light-induced evaporation. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, but for my benefit, someone would have to explain how the phenomenon works rather than just say it happens. Because it's very easy for lab errors to be introduced. As I mentioned before, light is energy, and energy can be transformed from one form to another. So it does produce heat. How do you get the light to not produce heat? It's going to produce some heat. So, again, I would like to know the mechanism involved in knocking water molecules off the surface, you know, getting across the surface tension of a container of water using photons without introducing increased average kinetic energy vis-a-vis temperature.
Good point, absolutely agree. Anyhow, the next one. Researchers create first in the history of human species, functional semiconductor made from graphite. And it was dated January 4, 2024, so it's Georgia Institute of Technology. They have created world's first functional semiconductor made from graphite. A single sheet of carbon atoms held together by the strongest bond, that's quartz. So we have a silicon, and that was what we were using long time. But we were also using quartz resonators before, and they are still in use. The problem here was the size. So when you're trying to miniaturize things in a wafer, the wafer is like a round disk, very thin one, where you have all of the microsheets, and then the machine will cut them after they are formed and put them into the plastic reflex with a wire connection into it. So the discovery comes at the time when silicon, the material form which nearly all modern electronics are made from, is reaching its limit in face of increasingly faster computing and smaller electronic devices. Sure.
Wesley?
Yeah.
someone out there is throwing a carrier out there. It's not really interrupting you or hopefully me, but it's just mildly annoying. So I just wanted to tell you. Also, I think you mean grapheme, not graphite. Graphite is not the same as graphene. Graphene is a single atomic layer of carbon, whereas graphite are multiple layers of graphene, stacked one on top of the other. It doesn't have the same amazing abilities that a single layer of graphene has.
Yeah, of course you're right. I was not talking about graphite. I was talking about graphene, but my pronunciation was graphene. So I'm sorry for that. Just give me a moment. I'm gonna have better signal.
This is not working.
Okay, well, what can you do? No, but they use a whole bunch of other substrates. They've been playing around with carbon in diamond form. It's highly conductive of heat, so it does a great job of heat dissipation. You could run it at higher speeds and higher temperatures and eliminate a lot more heat because of the diamond, the thermal conductivity of diamond. I used to do regular science discussions of graphene-related miracle materials. But the problem is you can't really manufacture large amounts of graphene for anything. You can do little scientific experiments on little teeny tiny pieces, but if you ever had to turn them in commercial things, you'd have a lot of problems.
Is it better now?
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Dr. Roy, is it better now?
It's fine. Well, we'll just not pay attention and go on from there. You do what you do.
Okay. Okay, well. We can talk philosophy too. And it's got reasoning. That reasoning is actually causing emotion or conduct or determining conduct of certain individuals. Okay. So. Right with my antenna. There isn't a job. Okay. So, that's my way of being immune for such a case. So, the way they did it is they still use silicon, so they have a substrate at which they put the graphene, thank you very much for correcting my English, graphene layer on it, and that's how they create a semiconductor. The good thing is that it allows miniaturization. I cannot find it, but 500 times smaller a semiconductor could be produced than it is now. 500 times. Oh boy. And then they say that the semiconductor has 10 times greater mobility than silicon. In other words, the electrons move with very low resistance, which in electronics translates to faster computing. That was the quote. Back to you, Dr. Wright.
Okay, I mean, silicon and carbon are on the same column in the periodic table. They're both semiconductors. So they're not quite great conductors, but they're not quite insulators either. then you dope them with different materials to produce PN junctions, and away you go. I really seriously doubt that you can shrink circuits by 500 using carbon. Carbon atoms are not really different, that different in size, as far as I'm aware, to silicon, which is the substrate that most semiconductors are made out today. You might be able to squeeze more transistors. It might allow for a little less internal resistance and so a little bit less heat that needed to be dissipated. The problem is how easy is it to generate a perfect graphene layer on top of the silicon? And, you know, what is the rate of misses? Because all these things are not perfect. So some percentage of the wafer has to be thrown away. So it'll be interesting to see what percentage that might be. It might not be cost effective because the amount of wafers that have to be disposed might be too great.
Okay, so, again, it is also interesting the way that the article is written. So, whether the authors are right or wrong, it is kind of interesting. It is kind of important, too. It is a Wright Brothers moment, Dr. Beer says. They build a plane, they could fly 200 feet through the air. Now what we have. So, it is a material that allows quantum mechanical wave properties of electrons to be utilized, which is required in quantum security. So it looks like we reached something that we never reached before, and we trust the opinion. Thank you.
Well, AC2GS, by the way, we'll have to see what works out. Yeah, these I never quite know whether it's really the scientists saying these things or the public relations at the universities that they work for saying these things. They tend to be optimistic, usually overly optimistic. Some of these things might pan out, but other things not necessarily. So,
the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater,
we'll see what happens.
Number 9126 on the New England Reflector.
Link active.
Okay, and last one. It is for Paul, our space guy. Four astronauts, including Turkish. Actually, it was Turkish, Italian, Turkish, Italy, and Switzerland. So that was four astronauts, including Turkish, first arrived at space station. So that would be something like a normal procedure, if not it was done by Axiom, Texas Axiom startup. Can I have Paul to comment on it?
Here, Wesley, WS to West.
Did you hear my question?
All I heard was the four people that went up on Axiom, and you named the countries that from, but I didn't hear a question attached to it. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, so the question wasn't really clearly formulated. It was a statement that Swiss, Italy, and Turkey. Astronauts were lifted by, and here is what I would love to hear more information, Texas Axiom startup. So we had SpaceX, we had the richest person in the world dealing with ISS, the International Space Station. And now we have Axiom. Could you say a few words about that?
No problem. Axiom like you said, it was the Axiom 3 mission. They've sent three missions up to the space station so far. Each one, they send a crew of four orbital flights. Peggy Whitson was the commander. They always take a commander that was an astronaut at one time with NASA that's retired. And the same with Algeria, the guy that's flying it now, also he flew many times on a space shuttle and did a lot of EVAs, so they got plenty of experience. But then the other three are all, they're paying Axiom to do this, and Axiom in turn is paying a couple of people to get the four people to the space station. They're paying Axiom, and for that service. And they also, Axiom also has to pay NASA thousands of dollars because they're using their equipment and services. The whole procedure of docking and everything. They're going to use. They're going to breathe the air from the space station. So NASA is charging Axiom money to do what they're doing. They don't have their own rockets going up, but they are building, they're in the process right now of building the first module that's going to be attached to the space station. Let me drop it. Okay, where they're docked now, they're docked to the Harmony module. That's the front end of the ISS. And sticking out in front of that, they have a pressure mating adapter 2, and that's what these are vehicles that, in this case, automatically, autonomously docks to it. That's eventually that piece that. That pressure mating adapter number 2 will eventually be not really needed because they intend on putting their own module that they're building right now in Italy. This company that builds these things, same company that builds the Cygnus cargo vehicle for NASA. They're building the main structure for it, and I think within a year they're going to be sending it to Texas they're going to install everything on there for human capabilities. Everything from bathrooms to sleeping quarters. It's going to be a regular module, and that's the first module. Once that's attached to the front of the Harmony module on the space station, they plan on attaching a couple more of these modules eventually, and another large module which will have bigger solar panels. So now time goes by. You can imagine as the years go by, this thing got bigger, and now you have four modules attached to the front end of the space station, and it's time to deorbit the International Space Station. So Axiom's plan is to disconnect right at that Harmony module where the first module we will be connected to, that will be separated. So that this whole thing will float away from the space station. It's got its own docking tower. It's got its own, a couple of docking towers, because, one for crews and one for cargo. And then you're going to have your own airlock if you need to do an EVA. And that will all be, that will float away, and they'll have their own commercial space station. That's the plan, big plan for Axiom. Back to you, Wes. WS2N.
Okay, so, in other words, it is the same SpaceX Crew Dragon capsule that is carrying four crew of Axiom Space, lifted from Cape Canaveral for a 36-hour flight to the orbiting lab in ISS, and the Axiom is being paid $55 million per each seat. So Axiom is actually not the person that is responsible that is making the hardware. Am I right?
Yeah, you got to think of it this way. The company that's just transporting everybody up and down is SpaceX on their Falcon rockets. They have customers. One of the customers is NASA, and NASA every 6 months pays SpaceX X amount of dollars to send their crew, again, of four people, up to the International Space Station to stay there for 6 months, and then return. So now you have a commercial company, Axiom, that is taking money from people around the world, like you said, around $50 million each, and they're taking that money, and they're paying, they have that money, they hire SpaceX to get me to the space station. And in the future, they'll be doing that as well with SpaceX, you know, transporting people up to the space station, to their own space station, you know, after the 2030s, you know, when they separate from the ISS. And you might have other companies like Sierra Nevada. By that time, they might have the Dream Chaser crew vehicle. They might be paying, you know, Axiom might pay Sierra Nevada to use their vehicle. And that, in that case, that vehicle could be mounted on an Atlas rocket, and Boeing would be getting money to transport Axiom people up to the space station. And, eventually you're going to have this system like different airlines. You have many different airlines, let me drop it, doing the same thing. They're all going to Hawaii, you know. Well, the same thing here. You're going to have many different companies going to the International Space Station. You're going to have, for crews, you're going to have SpaceX. You're going to have Blue Origin with the, they're developing a crew vehicle as well. You're going to have Boeing and Lockheed. It's called the United Launch Alliance. They're sending a crew up around 4 months from now. In April, they're actually going to be sending a crew up to the space station. So you're going to have all these different companies that have that capability. And so you think of it like that, and then you're going to have, you know, private entities like Axiom, and there's a couple of other ones that are into this as well. In the European Space Agency, they have there's a company doing it right now called Airbus. Airbus builds the big airplanes. Let me drop it. They're going to build their own space station, but to get their crews up to their space station when it's built somewhere down the line, they're going to be paying European Space Agency maybe to go up on the Ariane 6 rocket. You know, they plan on eventually someday having a crew launch on that thing. 10, 20 years from now, a different world. We won't be able to keep up with all the flights going up and down. As it is, I can't do it anyway right now. I try. Back to you, Wes, WS2S.
Thank you very much for that. Just one more thing to you, Paul. A few days ago, I was driving the car, and then I was switching from station to station. I heard the vehicle that's supposed to land on the moon was rerouted and burned up in the atmosphere. And I promised myself I'm going to check it out, what's going on, what am I missing, but I forgot, so just right now it popped to my mind. Could you give me more about it and picture it?
Okay. I know we covered it last week, and actually the previous week, and we're back in September, we covered it. And, you know, the month following that, on and off. And the one you're talking about is Peregrine, the Peregrine lander. And that was launched by Astrobotic. Astrobotic is a company that comes out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. they built this thing. They built the power grid and lander, and they had this thing launch on the top of a brand new rocket pool, Vulcan. And that was a couple of days after Christmas that thing went up. The Vulcan rocket was brand new, everything brand new. That worked 100%. Boeing and Lockheed are very happy with that. They'll be launching those things on a regular basis now because they got 100% rating on their new engines, their new second stage, everything new, newly designed. But the payload was the Peregrine spacecraft, and that was supposed to eventually go to the moon and land on the moon. And unfortunately, they had a leak, pressure regulating valve that operates the helium. They use helium to pressurize the tanks, fuel tanks and the oxygen tanks, and that's how the fuel gets pushed into the combustion chambers. Well, that valve didn't close on the helium side. And the helium side has like 3,000 psi inside, and the tanks themselves, fuel tank, oxygen tank, can only handle about 250 pounds. And that valve, since that regulating valve didn't close, it overpressurized. I believe it was the oxygen tank that really overpressurized, and that was ruptured. So that was essentially the end of the mission. It went around the moon and came back. It actually didn't go out to the moon orbit and then came back to Earth, and they made sure it burnt up in the Earth's atmosphere so it doesn't go around and around forever. Back to you, Wes.
Thank you very much, Paul, for all of the information that you gave me. Dr. Wright.
AC2GS, I'm here, Wesley. No other topics for tonight?
Just coming back to what we were talking already two times about, the differential mode and that we didn't talk about in addition to common mode in the balanced transmission lines, that so differential mode that supports open wire and waveguide. If you could specify the difference between the two. And there is another thing you said, the clockwise and counterclockwise is not important. But it is. But there are certain situations when you're winding the coil, it is and it is not. You could say a few words. And to actually it.
Okay. For the sake of an RF choke, it's not important. It's just how many turns determines the impedance and the common mode current. That's all. If it's counterclockwise, if it's clockwise, if they equal out, it doesn't really make any difference. In other cases, it might make a big difference, but we're not talking about other cases. We're just talking in the case of a common mode choke. Coaxial cables have a differential mode as well. The current going through the center wire and the inner aspect of the shielding is operating in differential mode in the same way that waveguides and open wires do. But in addition, there is a third kind of unthought of conductor with coaxial cables, which is the outer skin of the shield where common mode currents reflect back. But once again, there is a differential mode on coaxial cables. If there wasn't, no one in their right mind would use them as a transmission line.
It was rather for the purpose of fully address the question, and I thought that it is important if we add a little bit more information after that. together into the details. And I agree with you that when we try... So, if we want to do the coil, what is that we trying to achieve when we use the counterclockwise winding material?
Again, for the sake of impedance, of increasing the impedance of an inductor, none. It's the number of turns, whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise. The reason why very often one sees balance wound halfway, and then there's a run across the diameter, and then it's wound in the opposite direction, is simply that it's an aesthetically pleasing, balanced way of getting the two ends of the wire as far apart from each other as possible. You really don't want to bunch them together because depending upon different factors, you can have arcing between the two ends. So in the case of balance, that's my understanding of why that's done. There's nothing sophisticated in the world of physics that warrants it. It's just a neater and cleaner way of getting the two ends of the wire as physically apart from each other as humanly possible.
Yeah, you're talking about human open wire transmission line. I see the infinite number of distributed inductors and capacitors. And you're right, in terms of I agree, in terms of about counterclockwise, clockwise is not important. But in coils, if we wind clockwise, counterclockwise, then we have a close coupling. If it's one next on the other, the top of the other, then the inductance is being canceled, or partially canceled. So it's important. Actually, I was thinking about leads wire, where you could use, it's not a clockwise, counterclockwise, but you could use each individual wire to affect impedance in terms of inductance, inductive reactance, let's see.
I don't think there's a great deal you can't really reverse the effect of inductance. If that was the case, then a toroid that would...
you're there. Okay, audio. You lost audio.
Okay, the choice is equal.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, I'm back. Sorry, All-Star every so often takes a dirt nap. I don't think you're correct in that reverse winding will eliminate the inductance, because if that was the case, then toroids that were wired that way wouldn't be of any use. So I think something breaks down at that point.
There was a person with a low signal trying to say something to encryption.
Okay, well, I'll be listening.
KB2AGB.
Yes, AGB.
Hey, Roy, I pressed the play button on, but nothing happens, over.
Do you have the audio on your web browser set to the right volume? Sometimes people mute them, because the audio is going to be coming out of the browser. So if you could say run YouTube on the same browser and check to see if you have audio, that will be a good indicator.
Well, right now it's set at normal at the settings.
Well, I mean, the problem with Windows is there is no real sort of thing as normal. There are cases I've seen them where Windows just decides to mute a browser window, and if you don't go in and unmute it, it's muted forever and ever and ever. You could turn the speaker on in the front. You could turn the volume up. But like I said, what I would suggest is just give it a try. Use the same exact browser. Don't use a different type of browser. And go to some place like YouTube and just play a second or two to see if the audio plays from the browser.
Okay, so I go ahead and do that and I get audio. So what then after that, if that works?
Okay, I don't know what to tell you. You should be hearing the audio. There are people listening to the audio, so it must be coming out. You just have to make sure there's a little speaker on the side of the player. Make sure it doesn't have an X on it. That, you know, that mutes locally to that application. And make sure that the speaker is set for loud. You know, when you click on the little speaker icon, it'll give you an indication if it's set low or set high.
Okay. Now, it seems that press play to start speed. Now, what's that mean? Press play to start speed. I'm not really sure what that means.
Yeah, that's how the player works. So the player has a play button. It looks like a triangle. I think I mentioned it earlier on that you have to press that little play button to have it play the audio. It won't start. It doesn't self-start. So it's just kind of going to the link and the application showing itself on your web browser won't be playing anything. You have to take your cursor, move it over to the little triangle and click it, and then it'll start streaming.
Okay, well, Roger, I'm going to go to you two on the same browser, see if I got audio. All right, thank you. Back to you. King Bravo 2, I forgot what one.
Okay, you're welcome, John. Wesley?
Yeah, I think we've been on the subject three times too much. So, I think it's enough for that for tonight. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy, and... I think somebody still have a time to ask something. And to Xia.
Yes, indeed. We have some time left over. So if anyone has any topics or comments or questions, we prefer amateur radio-related questions, but anything in science and technology, I'm more than happy to attempt. So if anyone has anything to bring up, please hit that push to talk.
NY2H Mobile.
Yes, our own guardian angel Lou. How are you, Lou?
Okay, I'm on my way back from Merrick, almost home near Fort Jeff Station. So, you know, we had an outage. And we had to get Spectrum up there, and I want to thank Rob Jade for going up there and letting them in. What they did was they said they needed an attenuator on the modem. I guess the signal was a little too strong, so that's what they did. Now, I'm wondering if things are working. For the hour I've been listening in the mobile, I heard a couple of dropouts and timeouts and things like that. Right, I'm wondering if you're having to issue restarts or just, you know, how stable the system might be. Hopefully that attenuator wasn't too much that he put on, you know, too large of a value. Go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me as a problem. I dropped out of All-Star once, which is kind of something I've grown, unfortunately, used to. All it takes is to disconnect and reconnect, and it came back. Last week when, was it the week before? A couple weeks ago, when the whole thing kind of fell down and you had to reboot it, obviously going between disconnect and connect didn't do anything until you rebooted it. But tonight seems to be a regular day. I haven't noticed any excessive problems anywhere. Again, except for the almost weekly falling out of All-Star.
All right. Thank you for the report. We'll keep an eye on it. Glad Rob went up there today. It's a little hard sometimes dealing with the cable companies and setting things up properly and everything. But, it was their issue, and hopefully they resolved it. So, very good. Carry on, and I'll be clear. And Y2H Mobile.
Okay, very good, Lou. And we always appreciate all the people involved in the repeater technical committee. It's a thankless task, but someone has to do it, and you people do it great. And I really appreciate that because, you know, without that link, it would have been very problematic tonight without IRLP, without Echolink, without All-Star, which I've grown used to. And now John from Los Alamos is using All-Star as well. So we're turning into an All-Star family. So I thank you very much, Lou. And give my regards to everyone in the committee. We all appreciate their work. Okay, once again, I continue to be Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. This continues to be the Limark Technical Net. We do have a little bit more time, so if anyone has any questions or comments for tonight, please feel free, hit that push to talk.
AFP with a question.
Yes, certainly. What is it?
How to go about donating used amateur equipment to some needy person or group?
Okay, that's a very good question. My suggestion would be to contact local clubs in the area and advise them of your interest. Hopefully they have new members who are just starting off and asking a lot of questions and worrying about, you know, can they get something to get them started on the road. That would probably be my best first line. I mean, obviously you could go to different forums and websites and make offers of all kinds. But I really like the personal touch. So it depends upon where you're located. Find a couple of active clubs in the area and ask them if they have anyone who could use the help.
Thanks, Roy. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Yes, Paul.
WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
I've heard people donate stuff on the swap and shop. You know, they'll get on, talk to George, KD2FIU. Most Monday nights after the regular club net, you know, for the Limark starts at 8:30 and usually by 9 o'clock, they'll have the swap and shop. And George could help out. He would be able to give them some good information on what to do with equipment. Anyway, back to you. WS.
Yeah, Paul, that's always an option. But KB2AGP, I think, is located in Florida. So it'd be a heck of a transport to ship things back and forth, you know, from Florida to New York.
Oh, okay. I thought of you as well. Okay, fine business. Back to you.
Yeah, I appreciate John's question, especially. You know, new hams kind of benefit from a lot of things, mentorship. But also, you know, giving them equipment that is used and has been appreciated, so you can kind of bring it to the next generation. Because unfortunately, you know, a lot of this equipment, if you don't give it to someone, eventually family kind of looks at it and says, "Geez, what the heck is this?" And you know, it might spend the rest of its life in the back of a garage someplace. So. Share it. If you're so inclined, There's a lot of hams out there that are starting out. We're very fortunate in the United States. Unlike a lot of countries, the number of amateur radio operators licensed goes up every year instead of down. And, you know, some of them are just kind of preppers looking to have a couple extra frequencies. But other guys are really interested in the hobby and would benefit from equipment that you once used well but have moved on to other equipment. So I'm glad to hear John's question, because I hope we all should kind of keep that in the back of our head to pass things on. People were kind to us, I hope, and so be kind to others. Any other questions or comments for tonight? Please hit that push to talk. Ah, the sounds of silence. I know it well. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net, and we're open for business if anyone's interested. Anyone still has any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight, please hit that push to talk.
KD2ALP.
Yes.
Name is Ivan. I have a question. I'm relatively new. I have a couple years of hobby, like 2 years actually. And my questions might not be that interesting or even smart, but I don't understand one thing when you drop. Transmitting without an antenna. I just don't have a basic intuition as to why is it bad. The explanation that, oh, the power doesn't have anywhere to go. It has to go somewhere. It does not really doesn't give me intuition behind, oh, well, I have a light switch and I have a light bulb in the ceiling. I turn to flip the switch, the light bulb goes on, which is the load. I'll take the bulb out of the socket. Everything's fine. There's no load. There's voltage, but there's no load. The breaker doesn't trip. Nothing happens. I'm sure it's different. It's a bad analogy, but that's the way I'm seeing it. Can somebody give me an intuition? How does this thing work in the radio?
Yes, Ivan, I'd be more than happy. The problem is that alternating current and direct current don't work the same as radio frequency current. They tend to reflect. So what ordinarily happens with a transmitter is designed to output to a load of 50 ohms. The transmission line is designed to provide a impedance of 50 ohms. A resident antenna hopefully should establish a load of 50 ohms. At 50, at equal impedances along the way, you maximize the energy transmission from your transmitter to your transmission line to your antenna. And when you have a difference in impedance, you will have a decreased efficiency of energy transfer and you will have a reflection. I try and use this analogy. Sometimes people like it, some people don't. Impedance is sort of like transparent objects have optical density. Optical density is just another way of looking at impedance. And in this case, it's the electromagnetic waves of light rather than radio waves. And when light waves go from air with a certain optical density to glass that has a different optical density, the difference in optical density and or difference of impedance produces reflections that you see. When you go to a shop and you look through the glass, it looks transparent, but you do see a percentage of the light reflecting back, and you can see yourself in those reflections. So that's what's going on with radio waves and electromagnetic waves in general. If you have an open circuit, if you don't have a load that dissipates the energy, it's reflected back 100% into your transmitter, which hopefully is designed with safety circuits to trigger Otherwise, it will burn the circuits because the reflective power plus the power going through it will be too much for the design of the circuits. So with radio waves, there's reflections and too much energy burns out circuits. And also there's the efficiency of transfer with no antenna, everything kind of goes back on itself and feeds and heats up your circuits and burns them, unless you have safety circuits that trigger and lower your power output. Does that help?
Oh, certainly. That analogy that you're mentioning with optical, with transparent light waves, yeah, if I don't see my own reflection and just see what's on the other side of the glass, that means great, it's working great. So, in other words, the output of the radio already produces power, so the output is power, meaning volts times amps, so there are amps, and those amps are not being dissipated, right? Because if it's just voltage, then it should be all fine, it's just the potential sitting there. So the way I'm understanding it, so the radio already produces power, VI, so to speak, right?
Yeah, it's producing power, and you don't want to reflect it back into the circuits. You want all that power taken away and dissipated, preferably in radiation resistance, which is a fancy way of saying that the energy is dissipated as radio waves, and those are the signals you want to send out. And just as another corollary of that optical density thing, I'm sure you've seen it in YouTube where sometimes people will drop a transparent but very visible object into a glass of fluid, and because the optical density of the object and the fluid is identical, the object disappears from view because it has the same impedance or optical density. So that's another example of how equal impedances produce the most efficient transmissions of energies.
Understood. And another thing, just to kind of tie it all together, the connector itself, does the connector, in my instance, I have a DNA connector, does that count to dissipate power a little bit, or it's just a connector and it's totally isolated from the signal circuit?
Well, it's not isolated, it's part of the transmission line. Now, in a perfect world, you would want a connector that's designed with the exact same impedance. You would want a 50-ohm connector. Now, BNCs come in two types, and if you ever look at the specs of, say, BNC connectors, there are cable BNC connectors for cable TV that are 75 ohms because they use 75-ohm transmission lines. For hams, most hams will use the 50-ohm BNCs. But the UHF connectors that hams are very fond of don't have a 50-ohm impedance. They're, I think, something like a 35 ohms impedance. But because they're so small, the total amount of problems that they cause are inconsequential. But on a theoretical basis, you sort of want the transmission line and the connectors to have the exact same impedance. So you'll have absolutely no reflections and problems whatsoever. But, you know, we accept some little problems because, you know, when someone invented the UHF connector, they didn't seem to care about its impedance. Yes?
Yeah, I just think it's useful to make sure we use the word wave when we're talking about the propagation, because wave propagation is very similar in all mediums. And there's a really good video on YouTube. If you look up the Shively wave machine, there's a guy from like the 50s. It's a black and white video, but he has a physical machine that he uses to simulate, not simulate, it's real waves, it's not a simulation at all. It's a It's a physical wave machine that they built to demonstrate how waves propagate through all mediums, and light waves, RF, sound, even mechanical waves through mediums all behave in a very similar way. So it's very good video. So if you find the time, the other station I didn't catch the call sign, look up the Shively Wave Machine, or I also have a playlist on YouTube under my call sign if you search for TC2S.